The following is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Tracy Jenkins, the director of the Career and Professional Development Office. It's my pleasure to introduce John White tonight. And I actually have a full introduction, but we decided I'm just going to say, here's Johnny, for those of you who remember the Tonight Show, maybe not. It's a look me on your
side.
But Mr.
That
White
was funny.
Yeah, that
okay.
was pretty funny. That
yeah.
was my attempt at but Mr. White has a lot of great information, so very happy to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a real knee slapper. And in the world of patent law, you know, you take those opportunities, you just go with them, okay? Because after all, what's the definition of a patent attorney? You lack sufficient personality to do tax work. Yeah, that's right. And you're here to find out more about it. So brace yourselves, and in the event you want pizza, you better hurry because it's disappearing. But feel free while I'm talking to get up and go ahead and feed yourself. What is your next commitment? Is it 5:45, 6 o'clock? Or this takes about 40 minutes, okay? So in the event you need to excuse yourself ahead of time, go ahead. But remember this. This is my email. It's jwhite@pli.edu. jwhite@pli.edu. Also, for purposes of staying current on the exam, before you go, you're going to want to sign up for the PLI Law School email newsletter. Let me just give you a word of introduction about PLI, then I will introduce myself. PLI is a New York-based nonprofit that does continuing legal education, and they do continuing legal education across all legal disciplines. It's not just patents, it's not just copyrights, it's everything. It's landlord-tenant, it's SEC, it's IRS, it's anything that you may or may not be interested in. But the nifty thing about it, if you're in law school, it's all free. You can go to any one of these programs. They're principally in New York and in San Francisco, but many are also in Washington, D.C. So if you throw on a tie or a skirt, whatever you feel like wearing, and you go, you can go for nothing as a law student. And you can then find out, for example, if an area that you thought you were interested in is all that interesting, or you can forever cross it off your list. Okay, so take advantage of that. And the newsletter will simply keep you up to date with respect to what's happening on the exam. For example, recently you may have been paying attention or may not, but the Patent Office, thank you, proposed a bunch of new rules. The rules were about to go into effect, and they were thwarted by the Eastern District of Virginia just last Wednesday. The Patent Office, for the first time ever, was turned back in their efforts to make rules, which is really a wonderful thing if you're a patent attorney, because those rules were awful, and the Patent Office just didn't care how bad they were. So we're happy they were stopped. All right, so keep track, let us keep track of you and keep you informed. We'll tell you when rules are going to be tested and all that sort of thing. All right, now me. I am a patent attorney. I'm the roaming patent attorney. I travel the country for PLI teaching people how to get ready for the patent bar exam. I've been doing it now for about 20 years, which seems like a long time and probably is. But about half of all practicing patent attorneys have sat where you have sat and listened to me talk at them. So by now, that's a lot of people. That's about 14,000 people have passed through and listened to me tell them about stuff. So my information is current, it's reliable, and don't lose that email, jwhite@pli.edu, if you have questions. All right, let's talk about the exam, its history, and your experience on it if you end up signing up for it to take it. The exam has been around a long time, 50, 60, 70 years. It's unique. The Patent Office is the only government entity that sees fit to give you an exam before you can practice before it. Any other government entity is content If you're merely a lawyer, you know, that means you've gone to law school, you've taken and passed a bar exam somewhere. Patent office doesn't care if you're a lawyer. They don't care if you're in law school. They don't care about anything except whether you have a technical background in science or engineering or the rough equivalent of that in coursework, and you've taken and passed their exam. That's what they care about. Now, some people from time to time believe the rumor that gets started that says, oh, the patent office is going to do away with the exam because somehow it's unfair or it doesn't accommodate the various new technical disciplines that are coming along, you know, for example, biology and computer science. Well, I can assure you that a plan of wait it out is not a plan, okay? The exam will be there when your time arrives, okay? So you might as well think about how you want to approach this thing as opposed to what you can do to not face it. Now, the exam has changed, though. And if you ask a patent attorney that you know about their exam experience, they'll give you good answers and stuff. But it's going to be different from your exam experience. The exam, for example, always used to have a distinct morning and a distinct afternoon section. The morning was short answer, multiple choice. The afternoon was always written. That's not the case anymore. The exam is the same. The morning and the afternoon are 50 multiple choice questions with 5 possible answers. In addition, the exam always used to have a portion that was technically directed, mechanical, chemical, electrical. That's no longer the case. Everybody takes the same exam now. There is no technical elective portion. What this means is the biologists are taking the same exam as the chemists, as the electrical engineers, as the computer scientists. So the exam now has to be technically neutral. Technology is never a point of the question on the exam. Used to be it was, okay, but that went away about 4 years ago when the exam went fully electronic. And that's another thing. The exam is now administered on the day of your choosing. It's available literally any day of the year that you can get an appointment to sit for it at a local Prometrics facility. Prometrics. How many of you have heard of Prometrics? It gives lots of exams, you know, the various alphabet soup of grad school exams. It also might give contractor exams, real estate exams, typing tests, you know, all that sort of thing. Well, now they also give the patent bar exam or the patent agent's exam or the patent registration exam. Any of these names means the same thing. All right, now the exam itself, I've told you just a little, it's 100 questions. 50 in a morning, 3-hour segment, 50 in an afternoon, 3-hour segment, given on the same day, obviously, on a computer, it's all electronic, and you have a timed hour for lunch, so it's 3 hours, an hour, and then 3 hours on the day of your choosing, so you can take it any time of the year, summer, winter, spring, or fall, doesn't matter. And I said it is multiple choice. Now, what you know about that is they give you the answers. Multiple choice. There it is. All you have to do is pick it. Even better, they give you the source of all the questions. This thing called the MPEP, Manual of Patent Examining Procedure. How many of you have ever heard of this book, the Manual of Patent? That's a start. Are you guys examiners or... No? All right. Well, the MPEP is a great book, and if you sit down and read it, you'll be rewarded. No, you won't. Okay, its closest relative is the phone book, all right? And the phone book is far more interesting, all right? The MPEP is about a 3,000-page tome that talks about procedure and policy that relates to getting patent applications filed and processed through the patent office. That's what it's about. So, you have the questions, they give you the answers, they give you the source of all the questions. You only need to get a 70. How hard can it be? I mean, when was the last time you got a 70, right? I mean, long ago. And so, the pass rate is 50%. That's right. It's lower than any state-administered bar exam. And what's morale-breaking about that number is the people that sit for this are, without exception, scientists or engineers. Many in the life sciences area especially have advanced degrees. Many have PhDs. And half the test takers are lawyers. So they've already successfully taken one or more bar exams. And yet, they take this exam, they go down like wheat into a threshing machine. Okay, why is that? What seems to be the problem here? This is something you want to do, right? Right. All right, the problem is people think, well, it's open book. And so if I don't know anything, I can look it up. Okay, this is lie number one, okay? Whenever a test is open book, this means that if any one of us had all the time, we'd all get the right answers, right? You know, the blind squirrel eventually finds a nut, okay? Well, that means you don't have all the time. In fact, in truth, you can only look up about 5 questions on each half of the exam. So, because we're scientists or engineers, we can do the math, right? That means 90% of what they ask has to be here already. So therein lies at least part of the problem. People take it thinking, well, I know something about patent law, and what I don't know, I can look up. Okay, wrong. Next. It's the patent bar. It's got to be a test about patent law. Well, it is a little. All the law that they test, you can put on a single sheet of paper, double-sided. They test 35 U.S.C. 101, 102, 103, 112. That's it. Well, gee, what else are they asking about? The rest of that MPEP is what they're asking about. So people have a misconception. They think, well, you know, it's a bar exam, right? It's about law. Well, no, it's about policy and procedure and a little bit of law. And so people go down, not in flames, but they go down, and they fail with a 68, with a 69. People who pass, pass with a 70, 71, 72. That's right, the curve goes like this, right at 70. Nobody gets an 80. Nobody gets a 78. If you're really on your game, you get a 73, okay? So this is the kind of test it is. It is very intense, it's very dense, and you've got to be prepared for it. All right, let's talk about signing up for the exam. Suppose you want to take this thing. How do you go about doing it? Well, you need to get a copy of something I'm going to show you. It's called the General Requirements Bulletin. General Requirements Bulletin. This is available to you on the PTO website, which is uspto.gov, uspto.gov. Or you can go to our website, pli.edu, go to Bar Review, and we'll take you right to this link, okay, the General Requirements Bulletin. Get to this document somehow, download it, print it, because it details everything you need to do to jump through all the application papers, etc. Basically, what you need is an engineering or hard science undergraduate degree. You need transcripts that show evidence of that. And you need to fill out the application, and you need to send them a check for $390. Now, how many of you have an engineering or hard science degree? Hard science being biology, physics, chemistry, that sort of thing. How many? Okay. All right. For all you people, and this would be any engineering degree. Engineering degrees, I'd like to say that too. Any engineering degree or hard science degree qualifies you as Category A. Just remember that for a moment because I'll distinguish there in a moment. Category B is people who do not have an engineering or science undergrad but have an approximation of it. And this would typically be your pre-med people and others who were on their way to an engineering degree but somehow got diverted, you know. Or maybe they were history majors but they had a serious hobby in physics. In fact, it was so serious they took 24 semester hours in physics with lab on their way through their history or, for example, their music degree. Okay, they really wanted to know how that trombone worked. All right, if you're that person, you would qualify into Category B. Now, this also includes 32 semester hours in a combination consisting of 8 semester hours in chemistry or physics, 24 semester hours in a combination of biology, botany, microbiology, molecular biology, and so forth. And then there's option 3, which is 30 semester hours in chemistry. You know, maybe you're on your way to a pharmacology degree. Option 4, 40 semester hours in a combination of hard science subjects. Now, that's Category B. And you may be almost there. You may, for example, lack a course in physics or a course in chemistry. It's okay. You can pick it up at the local junior college, wherever you can get a course that would ultimately go toward an accredited degree in that topic. Okay. Now, I've had some people be so fired up about becoming a patent attorney after this talk that they immediately head out to get 24 semester hours in physics. Okay. Now, that's probably a pretty tall order, but by golly, if you want to do it, okay. But hopefully, you know, if you don't have a science or engineering background, you have a lot of what would qualify under Category B. Interestingly, people who have service academy degrees, that is Annapolis, West Point, Air Force Academy, they don't qualify under Category A, but they can under Category B. You know, they're almost there. They just need typically a few more courses in physics. All right, so that's Category B. Category C is, you know, as always, there is the other category. And other means you have something that shows you have this kind of knowledge, and that is typically the fundamentals of engineering exam or engineer in training exam that's administered by a state. Now, some of you may have taken that, you know, your last year at engineering school. That's the first step typically on your way to becoming a registered or licensed professional engineer in that state. I took it, I think, in my senior year down at Virginia Tech, but I didn't do the second half. Well, they're just looking for that first test, you know, that you would have taken towards the end of your engineering program. That's Category C. Now, why this matters is Category A, once you get your transcripts, send them money, fill out the application, and so forth, is turned around in about a week to 10 days from the patent office. Category B, 3 to 4 weeks. Category C, well, as long as it takes. But what they do when you send it to the patent office is they send you an admission ticket to the exam. And what they give you is a 90-day window, 90-day window within which you contact, schedule, and take your exam at the Prometrics facility of your choice. So you have a 90-day window to get this done. Now, Prometrics has about 400 facilities across the country. Around here, they're typically associated with a Sylvan Learning Center. And what they are is a room, you know, divided into little computer stations. They'll have a screen, a keyboard, and about 3 feet of desk space. You go in there with nothing except a couple of number two pencils to fill in the screen. It's a joke. Okay. That's for scratch paper, which they give you and take from you when you're done. You go in there with nothing. Okay? Not your MPEP, not nothing. What they give you is some scratch paper and what's on the screen. The screen will have the questions and access to a PDF version, searchable, but nonetheless a PDF, of the MPEP, the one that's being tested. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So you have 90 days to do that. At the end of the exam, that afternoon, at the moment you finish, they will give you the information as to whether you passed. Okay? That can be good and bad, you know. At least they don't, halfway through the afternoon, say, stop. There aren't enough questions left for you to pass. Go home now, okay? Start the rehab. No, they don't say that. They tell you right there at the end, preliminarily, you've passed. Now, happily, they've never turned one of those decisions around. Okay, you passed. Oops, sorry, you failed. They've never done that. They have said you failed. Hey, you passed when they've thrown out some questions. But they've never gone the other way, saying you passed, then oops, you failed. All right. So that's signing up for the exam. Basically, science or engineering background gets you in along with some money. No legal training is necessary to qualify you. Okay, nothing you're doing in law school is going to further your credential to get into the exam. You either have that or you don't at this point. So the question is, when should you take this exam? Well, as busy as you think you are in law school, I can assure you that you can find a day out of 90 to take an exam. And this is especially true since many of these centers, and this is a center anywhere you want, it can be one near here or where you're going to be, you know, over a break or something like that. You can find a day out of 90 because Saturdays are typically included. Most of these places are also open on Saturdays. So you can find a day. But that's not the problem in getting this exam out of the way. The problem is, when do you have time to prepare, and what will that preparation involve? Well, if you want to, you can prepare on your own. Preparing on your own means getting a copy of that MPEP, getting the right one, okay? The one that is currently used is the 8th edition, 6th revision. That's what is in effect right now, today, on the PTO website. That is not what's tested. What's tested is 8th edition, 4th revision. So, study the right MPEP. They'll tell you that on the Patent Office website at the Office of Enrollment and Discipline. Get the right one to study. Next, get some old exams. Patent Office will give you 100 old exam questions. PLI, our website, will give you another 400 old questions, which I've gotten rid of all the old questions that are no longer any good. So, get old exams, get the MPEP, set aside 300 hours. That will get you ready for the exam. Now, 300 hours, that's 300 hours. Yeah, that's the summer, right? That's a lot of time. So you might think, well, maybe I'll take a course. All right, that's probably a good idea. There's several available. I teach one, and I've taught all the others. But a course will still require a lot of time. We're going to take your prep time from 300 hours to maybe 150. So, you know, 150, that's more manageable. That's half the summer. That's all of a break, you know, depending on when you time your breaks and so forth. The other thing about courses is you got to pick one that works for you if you're going to do it. There's generally two varieties. There's live and there's home study. Ours is available in those formats. You have to understand your own personality. A live course has a deadline. You show up, you sit there in a classroom environment, somebody like me, or if you take my course, me, talks to you for 50 hours over the course of 5 days. It's one of these total immersion experiences. You have time for nothing else except eating and sleeping over the course of 5 days, but very efficient. You will have been dragged through every testable topic. What remains is 100 hours of self-study where you work with software and you practice answering questions and manipulating the PDF MPEP, which we have on the software. Now, that appeals to a lot of people because it has a date associated with it. But then there's home study. People pass just as well with home study, but understand that takes a certain amount of discipline and commitment. You know, the box shows up, but the information isn't going to spring from that box into your head, okay? You have to open it. You have to commit to a schedule. You got to work your way through it over about a 6 to 8 week period, fitting it in between, you know, your other commitments, law school, that sort of thing. It's entirely doable. But you have to understand, are you the kind of person that needs a deadline thrust upon you, like me, or are you the kind of person that can find that discipline and commitment and, you know, work it all out and get it done on your own? It's up to you to determine, you know, which suits you best. Pass rate's the same, home study and live. Now, the other difference, though, is if you're going to take a live course, don't forget you got to travel somewhere and stay there and eat over the 5 days. So even if they cost the same, bear in mind the live course may have an expense component, you know, depending on where you take it. So keep that in mind. But 150 hours, that's still not trivial, is it? You know, it's not something you just, I'll fit it in somewhere. It's a lot of time. So when are you going to find that time? Well, let's talk about your law school experience and how much flexibility you have now and what happens after law school. Because you may think, you know, I'm busy enough. I'm in school. I've got other stuff. I don't really feel like working on that while I'm in law school. Okay. Well, let's put it off. Let's wait till you're done with law school and you're working. Okay, now, how much free time do you have? Okay, that good job that you have that pays you so much, that surprises all your relatives and peers, well, you get all that because you show up early, you work hard, you stay late, you are sometimes there on Saturday. The first years of working as a lawyer are not your happiest times as a lawyer because they are, without a doubt, the busiest time you'll ever have as a lawyer. And so, when are you going to find that 150 hours then? You know, the exam didn't get easier because you're a lawyer. Remember that pass rate? In addition, the prep time didn't disappear because you're a lawyer. So, do you want that waiting for you after law school? Either the pass rate effect or the time effect. Do you want that hanging out there? You know, not if you can help it. Now, some of you, you're already there. You know, I'm a third year. Oops. All right. Well, then you've got to make the best of it. But if you can, if you're ahead of that, and you can find the time to get this out of the way, if it's something you really want to do, do it. Not just for the flexibility and timing of everything, but what happens if you pass it? Well, you become registered to practice at the patent office. A registered agent, which is what they call you if you don't have a law degree and a bar admission, can do anything at the patent office that a registered attorney can do. There's no difference at all. Registered agent, registered attorney. The only difference is one has taken and passed a state bar somewhere. But at the patent office, there's no distinction at all. The distinction is outside the patent office. An attorney can litigate. They can offer opinions. They can give advice. They can do that sort of thing. Agents don't do any of that. But at the patent office, they're the same. Well, that means as a registered agent, you can work as, for example, a registered agent. Go to a law firm, you can write and file applications. You can do anything a patent attorney can do with respect to the patent office. And since you're here in Washington, D.C., and you're near Northern Virginia, you are in the largest concentration of patent attorneys in the world. That's right, right here. This is Patent Central. So you can get a part-time job and you can make, for example, real money. That's right, patent agents make real money. Certainly more than law clerks. So keep that in mind. In addition, it is a resume builder. If two resumes arrive, one has this credential on it, they are otherwise similar, who do you think gets the nod? The one that has already demonstrated the capacity and the commitment to take and pass this exam. But this isn't something you should undertake lightly. This is still 150 hours. You know, and if you take a course, it's going to be costly as well. So, you know, think about this. But once you've determined it is something you're going to want to do, start trying to fit it into your schedule. Okay? All right, any questions that you may have that I didn't answer with my talk about the exam, signing up for it, when to take it, anything like that? Okay. You want to hear about what patent attorneys do, where, and how much they get paid? Huh? Say, yeah, why not? While we're here. All right. Patent attorneys sort of divide into two groups, more or less. One group does litigation, the other group does prosecution. Now, litigating a patent is like litigating anything else, okay? You wake up angry and you stay that way for 10 years, okay? It's just the way it goes.
And in between, you drink coffee. No, litigating a patent is a full-time, total commitment. That's the nature of litigation. You're on the schedule of some federal district court somewhere. That's where patents are litigated. It's exclusively a federal matter. There is no local or state court that will have anything to do with a patent. This is unlike copyrights, trademarks, and unfair trade, where there is some local court action. Not so in patents. It's exclusively at the federal district court level, and your appeals court is right down here in Washington, D.C., next to the White House. It's the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And so, you will spend your time roaming around the United States to the jurisdiction where infringement is occurring, but remarkably, a lot of infringement seems to occur in the Eastern District of Virginia and the Eastern District of Texas. What are they? They are the two rocket dockets that have to do with patents. You go from filing to final decision in 12 months. In the patent world, that is light speed. Okay? Because you could be, for example, in the District Court for the District of Connecticut, where it takes 14 years from filing to trial. No decision yet, just the trial. That's right. Clearly, the judge hopes this will simply settle and go away. Okay. So, you're in a federal district court. You're running according to the court schedule. And there is a unique characteristic of U.S. patent practice. Half of all U.S. applications that become patents start outside the United States. In Germany, in Japan, in Russia, South Africa, Australia, wherever. The point being, that's where your inventors are, that's where your documents are, that's where your discovery will take place. That's right. You will be at the four points of the earth looking for stuff with an interpreter or two. Okay, that's the way it goes in patents. It's kind of exciting and dull. All right, so keep that in mind. That's right. It's everything and more. So, there you are, in federal district court somewhere, having a grand old time. Now, what else can you do as a patent attorney? Well, you can prosecute. And prosecute is the label we give to those who write and file and pursue, on behalf of others, patent applications filed at the patent office. This is prosecution. It is non-adversarial. It's just you and the patent examiner, and you work out any issues. And eventually, hopefully, you get a patent out of the patent office. And this happens about 75% of the time. But you have a docket, an active docket. Your active docket is maybe 300 or 400 cases. And it's constantly churning through the patent office slowly and predictably. But you've got to be there to tend to your docket. At any given time, you have a rejection, you filed a response, a paper needs to be filed, a signature needs to be obtained from a client. You know, all of these things are constantly occurring with respect to your docket, and so it requires constant tending. Now, if you're doing that, you can't litigate, because litigation, suddenly, you could be at one of those points of the compass, okay, leaving your prosecution docket to die. Well, you can't do that. And so patent attorneys typically prosecute or they litigate. But here's the thing. You can't be an effective prosecutor unless you know very well how to litigate. You can't be an effective litigator unless you know very well how to prosecute. But you can't do both. But you have to know how to do both. Okay. Now, in between these things, you can license, you can give opinions, you can do transactional stuff. And either prosecutors or litigators can handle that sort of thing. Now, what sort of job opportunity do you have, or where does this take place? Well, let's start with the most common job opportunity and then kind of walk our way through what else is out there. A job opportunity has come about in the past 15 years or so, certainly since the time I came into the profession. And it is now the most common opportunity for you, and that is working in a patent group or department in a general practice firm. Now, this has come about because so much is at stake in patent cases, and specifically so much money is spent litigating them. The average cost to get a patent case to trial is $2 million. Okay? General practice firms need to hear nothing further. That is what they need. They need money to support, you know, the activities of the firm. Patent cases are the most expensive to litigate. As a result, over the past decade and a half, many patent boutiques, which still exist, but many don't, they were taken up by a general practice firm. When I came out of law school in the middle 80s, patent attorneys went off and practiced with other patent attorneys. There was no opportunity at a general practice firm. There were only patent specialty firms. You left law school, and that was the last time you ever talked to anybody who was talking about anything except patent law. You went off with your pocket protector wearing friends, and that was it, okay? And if somebody showed up with a legal problem, you'd say, there aren't any lawyers here. We're patent attorneys. Oh, sorry. Forgetting that you went to law school and you did all that other stuff. Now you are just a patent specialist. Well, that's all changed. You can get a job at a big general practice firm now and work in the patent group or department. What this means is you can not only do that, you can do anything else you found interesting in law school. I'm sure there's something you're doing here that's interesting, and so you can pursue those things if you want at a general practice firm, and you can also be in the patent group or department. There are also patent boutiques. Now, boutique has the connotation two, actually. One, specialization, and the second, size. It's not very big. Well, the size thing is not quite true here in the Washington area especially. There are some very large patent boutiques here. 200 and 300 attorney firms that are, quote, boutiques, and that would be Finnegan, Shugrue, Oblon. These are great big firms, but all they do is patent work. Now, there is other work thrown in, you know, a little trademark, a little copyright, but it's ancillary to the patent work. What happens is if someone swiped your invention, they probably took the instructions too, okay? That's a copyright violation. And if they were trying to pass it off as yours, well, that's counterfeiting and probably also a trademark violation. So that gets thrown into the mix, you know, at the time you file the patent pleading. And the reason they do mostly patent work as opposed to intellectual property is there's no barrier for any other attorney to do copyrights and trademarks, right? You don't have to be registered or pass this crazy exam in order to call yourself a trademark attorney. You just show up. So, patent firms do patent work. That's what they do. The other stuff is kind of a throw-in. So, there's a couple of big boutiques in Washington. You'll find big boutiques in New York, Chicago, and out on the West Coast as well, but that's probably nowhere else. You'll find the big general practice firms in almost every large city, certainly several here in Washington, New York, Chicago, and so forth. There's going to be some big general practice firms with patent departments. Now, smaller patent boutiques, and I would say 50 lawyers and under, you'll find them pretty much all over the place, certainly several here in Washington, D.C., but also around the place. Now, you'll find them all the way down to a clutch of attorneys, you know, five or six working in a boutique. What you have to know is the smaller the firm, the less litigation you're going to do. And certainly in a small firm, you're not going to be litigating for, you know, Ford Motor Company or something like that. You'll be litigating for a small company that has some patent issues. If you want big litigation, you got to go with a big boutique or a fairly large general practice firm. Now, you can also work for the government. Now, the government has lots of patent attorneys. And the reason is the government spends a fortune on research and development. Now, a lot of it is spent through the Defense Department and so forth, but a lot of it is spent through the Department of Agriculture, Energy, you know, what have you. The government spends a pile of money, and, you know, you'll be wherever that pile of money is being spent. For example, if you work for Department of Energy, you might be out at Los Alamos. You might be at Lawrence Livermore. You might be at Sandia Labs. If you work for NASA, you might be in Huntsville, Houston, down at Cape Kennedy or out at Jet Propulsion. You know, you'll be wherever that work is being done. Department of Navy, you might find yourself in San Diego, Norfolk, or here at the Naval Research Lab. So the government has lots of patent attorneys working wherever the work is being done. You can also work for the Patent Office. You know, no surprise there. The Patent Office is here in Alexandria. They have lots of patent attorneys working there, although you don't need to be a patent attorney to be a patent examiner. Many are qualified and have law degrees. But you can work in the solicitor's office and so forth. Lots of patent attorneys working there. Another place you can work is at a university. Any, almost, university at this point has considerable research that's ongoing, and if they protect that research with patents, they get to take the money off of it. So universities are, as they say, highly motivated in this regard, and there will be tech transfer offices that have patent attorneys. And finally, you can work for a company, go in-house and work for whoever it is, IBM, Xerox, Apple, Microsoft, whomever. They have patent attorneys. Now, the distinction is that in the government, in companies, and at universities, you probably won't do any litigation. You might write the occasional threatening letter or something like that, but you're not going to be arguing motions or taking depositions or, you know, doing witnesses or anything like that in association with court cases. You would manage litigation, especially in a company. You would hire a firm and make sure the litigation is well represented and your witnesses are made available and all that sort of thing on a timely basis. But you probably wouldn't do a lot of it yourself. So, you know, keep that in mind. You know, eventually you will figure out what it is you like about being a patent attorney, litigation, prosecution, and so forth, and you will find where it is that you can do that. Now, where are patent attorneys? Well, Washington and Northern Virginia has the largest concentration. About 20% of all patent attorneys in the United States are here in this area. For whatever reason, there's very few patent attorneys who work in Maryland, or admit it, but they live there, but they work in D.C. or they work in Northern Virginia. Outside, and here, because the patent office is here and half of all applications start from outside the United States, you have a real natural gravity here. You have all jobs. You have big firms with patent departments. You have big boutiques, small boutiques. You have government jobs. What you don't have are very many company jobs, companies. And that's because there aren't that many companies around here. You know, there's defense contractors and stuff like that, and there's ExxonMobil, you know, because they run the country. But outside of them, it's funny too, and topical, and topical. In any case, there aren't that many companies around here, and the ones there are seem to be shrinking like AOL. So anyway, everything else, though, is available here, and every technical discipline. So regardless of your technical background, there is a job for you here somewhere. The next largest gathering is going to be New York City and Northern New Jersey, Connecticut, and so forth. What you're going to find up there is pretty much the same mix as you do in the greater Washington area, except company jobs are going to be much more prevalent than government jobs. Okay, so similar number of jobs maybe, but the government contingent is replaced by the company contingent. So that's New York City. Next, you have Chicago. Chicago is like a small New York, and what I mean is it's the same mix, the same kind of stuff as New York City and so forth, but just fewer in number, about one-third as many in Chicago as you have in the greater New York area. The next largest gathering of patent attorneys is the state of California. The state of California in its entirety has about the same number of patent attorneys as the Northern Virginia and D.C. area. The difference is they're spread all over the state, and it's regionally relevant as to technical background and things you might expect to find. Northern California includes San Francisco, the Bay Area, Silicon Valley. What are you going to find? Chips and software, right? the middle part of the state, Thousand Oaks and so forth, you're going to find Amgen, Genentech, that's biotech and chemistry. Southern California, we're going to talk about L.A. Well, it has a little bit of everything, but it's all over. Pasadena, Century City, downtown, Santa Monica, Long Beach, Newport. It's all there somewhere, okay, but it's all over the place in Southern California. San Diego, chips and biotech and some software down there. Coming across the Sun Belt, there's nothing happening in Arizona, a little bit in Phoenix. You know, Intel has some stuff out there. Keep coming. New Mexico, nope, nothing there, really. Government jobs, Sandia, Los Alamos. Then you get to Texas. Texas has some jobs. They are around Dallas and Austin and Houston. But Dallas is chips, software, and some mineral and, you know, natural resource exploitation. Down in Austin, it's more chips and software. Houston is all oil and gas, okay? That's the center of the oil and gas universe. Don't even drive down the highway unless you have chemistry or geology or something like that, okay? As you come across the South, there are no patent attorneys, okay? Mississippi has six, okay? Obviously, they're laws. Arkansas, eight. And they all work for Walmart and Tyson Chicken. You come across the South, there aren't any, okay? Tennessee used to have one in Nashville, obviously still trying to sing. Keep coming across the South. You know, Alabama has 300. Now you think, what, hunting? What are they doing there? They're at Huntsville, okay? That's NASA territory. And then you get to Georgia. Georgia has about 300. Center for Disease Control, Atlanta, biotech and stuff. Florida has lots of patent attorneys. They're all retired. Okay. Nothing happens in Florida, okay? Nothing. People fish, and they wait. Then you go north from Georgia, you get into the Carolinas. Nothing really happening in South Carolina. It's beginning to happen. Now, I should say, through the Bible Belt, okay, as opposed to the Sun Belt. You guys got a Rust Belt, Bible Belt, Sun Belt? You know, come on. Left coast, right coast, okay. In the Bible Belt, you're not going to have a lot of patent attorneys, but it's beginning to happen because the Rust Belt manufacturing is slowly coming south, right? To Tennessee, to the Carolinas, Alabama, and so forth. You have these relocating manufacturers. And so in South Carolina, you have BMW showing up down there. In Alabama, you have Mercedes. In Tennessee, you have Nissan and Kubota and others. So you do have manufacturing slowly coming down out of the Rust Belt. In North Carolina, you have Research Triangle, another 300 to 400 patent attorneys. This is mostly bio and pharma, but other stuff as well. And that's in the Raleigh-Durham area, you know, down there. And then you get back up to Washington. Now, through the Rust Belt, you have pockets of patent attorneys, and they do whatever the local industry does or did. Okay, so Detroit, automotive stuff and so forth. Pittsburgh, steel, paints, finishes, stuff like that. Akron, polymer capital of the world. Yeah. Goodyear, BF Goodrich, Firestone, Quaker Oats, Hoover Vacuums. Come on. Anyway, it's all out there somewhere. And you'll find one firm and then a firm to compete with them, okay, but not much activity out there. Most of it is on the coasts and increasingly in the near south. Now, what do they get paid out there? Well, patent attorneys at big firms in big cities start at about $145,000 a year, some even a little bit more than that, maybe $150,000. Now, those are, you know, at the big firms, general practice firms, and those are the kids from the best schools. And you get paid a little bit less, you know, as you get further from those big centers into smaller towns until finally you're in-house or in the government. But patent attorneys, you have to understand, are generally resented by everybody because they're paid more when they come out of law school and they're paid more for the rest of their career. Okay, it's a burden. But you're just going to have to put up with it. Okay, so how do you succeed as a patent attorney? Be one. Okay. Where do you have to finish in your class? top 100%. Okay? What you have to do is show up. All right? While the rest of your peers are worried about class rank and law review and publications, you merely have to put on the black robe and walk across the dais, wave to the folks, and head to your job. Okay? That's the way it goes as a patent attorney. The first hire I ever made when I started my own firm was a graduate from here. That's right, a graduate from American. Many years ago, I might add, in 92 maybe. And I paid for him to attend this place, but that's before it was this place. It was the other place back then, the small, leaky Warren. But it's nice now, parking, all that sort of thing. So anyway, any questions about careers, opportunity? The fortune you're going to make? No? Okay. How many are going to take the patent bar? That's what I like to see. Come on, two hands for those who want to take it twice.
What about people that don't have a technical background?
That's a shame. No, what you can be is category B. Do you have any technical background? Oh!
Fred, I'll give you a crash course.
That's right. Darn! Well, then your quickest way there is 24 semester hours in physics.
Can you attend foreign universities?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it doesn't have to be domestic university or domestic degree. I mean, it can be a degree in physics from, you know, Max Planck or wherever, you know.
And 24 hours, that's a year.
Is it?
Can you? Classes, probably.
Huh? Well, yeah, eight classes. They got to have big classes with labs. And they have to be physics for physics majors, not, you know, physics for history majors, you know. None of that stuff. Not the history of physics, but, you know, this hits this, ouch.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I was just wondering why science at all, because I've talked to some patent attorneys and they basically say that, you know, they can't remember a lick of their biochem from undergrad.
Well, and you see, that is the basis of that ugly rumor that starts about every 3 or 4 years that says, oh, the patent office is giving up on the exam. Now, this rumor started about 50 years ago, and it hasn't been true. For some reason, they feel that it is a unique requirement that they're going to maintain, you know, forever. Whether it's rational or worthwhile, I can't tell you, but I don't see it going away anytime soon.
I'm a category B option 4 guy because my undergraduate computer science was not ABE accredited until
darn
7 years after I graduated. So
yeah, but
what I have is kind of twofold. I got AP credit for 2 semesters of physics. I was required to take a lab, so I took that in Arizona State over the summer. It was 3 credit hours for each class plus a lab requirement. Do I need to get my ASU transcript in addition to my Penn transcript, which just says AP Physics?
Yes. You need every transcript that shows anything you're going to assert. Sadly. But if your program was accredited after you did it, I would get a copy of the current accredited program and coursework and say, look, see, I did it before it was accredited. Same thing. And they'll go, you know, you're right. You're in. Try that. Because what they're looking for is you have what they require or you have the equivalent. And if you demonstrate and make it easy for them to understand you have the equivalent, you're in. All right. Well, look, get the free stuff and sign up for the newsletter because I'll tell you what version of the MPEP they're testing and I'll keep you up to date on what's happening at the patent office. All right? Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Woo!